Good morning, everybody. So to begin, I have no financial relationships to disclose. So neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, is a postnatal drug withdrawal syndrome that commonly occurs after intrauterine opioid exposure. Common symptoms of NAS in infants include high-pitched crying and irritability, feeding difficulties, tremors or hyperactive reflexes, yawning and sneezing, vomiting, diarrhea, and failure to thrive, and temperature instability. Treatment of these symptoms is typically achieved in one of two ways. Non-pharmacologic supportive care, such as swaddling or minimizing environmental stimuli, or pharmacologic opioid replacement therapy, such as through morphine, buprenorphine, or methadone. In conjunction with the ongoing opioid epidemic, we've seen that NAS has become a growing problem in the United States and around the world. As shown in this figure, the rate of NAS in the United States has increased from 1.2 to 5.8 cases per 1,000 live births between 2000 and 2012. Unfortunately, this translates to a baby being born in the United States every 25 minutes who's affected by opioid withdrawal. As demonstrated by our hospital discharge data, in Tennessee, we've had a greater than 1,700% increase in rates of NAS since 1999, from 0.7 to 13 cases per 1,000 live births. However, as you see on this map, different portions of the state are disproportionately affected. The six eastern Tennessee counties denoted with a blue star have rates of NAS that exceed 50 cases per 1,000 live births. So in 2015, the Tennessee Department of Health heard some anecdotal reports from local educators in that part of the state that children with a history of NAS had greater learning challenges or behavioral difficulties that they were observing in the classroom. However, to date, no studies examining educational outcomes among children with a history of NAS in the United States have been completed. So our goal was to examine associations between a history of NAS and educational outcomes. So given the reports that we had received and the data that was available, we focused on special education outcomes. To give a little bit of background, beginning at age 3, children can be referred for evaluation to determine their eligibility for special education services. If they're deemed eligible, these services available services persist through them through age 21. And of note, beginning at birth through age 3, similar evaluation and services are available through early intervention services, which in Tennessee is called TEIS. So in Tennessee, there are currently 16 qualifying educational disabilities, which are all listed here. I'll give you just a second to glance over all of them. I think it's, if you notice, it's always surprising to people that being intellectually gifted is considered an educational disability, but as we'll discuss, that's really just to make sure that they have appropriate learning plans in place, and this is sort of the only way in the school system to ensure that children can deviate from the normal sort of standard curriculum, and so that exists on across the spectrum. So the process begins when a child is referred for evaluation of a possible disability. This can be initiated from the school system, from a parent, or from early intervention services. The child will then undergo evaluation by an assessment team, and they're guided by specific criteria for the 16 disabilities that I just showed. Based on these results, the child will then undergo an eligibility determination to establish if they meet criteria and qualify for one of those disabilities. Those that are eligible will receive a written individualized education program, or IEP, a term that may be familiar to some of you, which is specific to their needs. And through their IEP, the children will receive specialized services, therapies, or accommodations. Examples of this include physical, occupational, or speech therapy, extra time to take an exam, or modified assignments. So the existence of this special education system and available services is mandated by federal law through the Individuals with Disabilities Act, which was originally established in 1975. And as I sort of alluded to, it basically just ensures that children with disabilities have the opportunity to receive free, appropriate public education. So to create our data set, we first decided to focus on children born in Tennessee between 2008 and 2011. Next, we utilized Tennessee Medicaid, or TennCare, insurance claims data to identify infants born during our time frame of interest with a history of NAS by ICD-9 diagnosis code. Of note, over 90% of children with a history of NAS in Tennessee are enrolled in 10 care. Next, these children with a history of NAS were matched in a 1-to-3 ratio to children without a history of NAS, identified from birth certificate data, who were also enrolled in 10 care. They were matched on sex, race, ethnicity, kindergarten cohort as a proxy for age, and public health region of residence. So this yielded 1,815 children with a history of NAS and 5,445 children without a history of NAS. Identifiers from this data set were then provided to the Tennessee Department of Education for linkage to a real-time special education database. So we were interested in three primary outcomes: referral for evaluation of a possible disability, results of the eligibility determination, and implementation of various services. We used Pearson's chi-square to make descriptive comparisons between groups and conditional multivariable logistic regression to examine associations between a history of NAS and our outcomes of interest. So in accordance with our matching, there were no significant differences between groups with regards to sex, race, age, region of residence, or 10 care insurance status. However, there were some important differences. A significantly higher proportion of children with a history of NAS were born low birth weight, less than 2,500 grams, born preterm at less than 37 weeks, required admission to the neonatal intensive care unit, and had mothers who used tobacco during pregnancy. However, it's important to note that these differences are not surprising. Prior studies have shown that infants with NAS are more likely to have adverse neonatal outcomes or neonatal complications such as these, and that maternal tobacco use is a risk factor for the development of NAS. But all of these factors have also been shown to be independent predictors of poor educational outcomes, which I'll discuss a little bit more later. So our first outcome of interest was referral for evaluation of a possible disability. Descriptive analysis showed that children with NAS, shown in purple, were significantly more likely to be referred for evaluation than those without NAS, shown in green. Before reviewing the results of the logistic regression, I'm going to deviate for just a second to discuss our model just a little bit and why we chose to control for the factors that we chose to control for. So we first constructed a directed acyclic graph based on an extensive review of the literature in order to help us better understand this really complicated interplay of a lot of different factors. So as I alluded to briefly, there aren't too many things that cause NAS. So obviously, exposure to opioids or other drugs in utero is the predominant cause. But there has been some evidence that some other factors, such as maternal smoking or maternal use of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, during pregnancy, can increase the risk of the development of NAS in children who are also exposed to opioids. So unfortunately, we didn't have some of this data available, but we did have maternal smoking status data available and chose to control for it as a potential confounder. Now, we also know that being of a certain demographic or socioeconomic status doesn't cause NAS, but we certainly see certain trends and commonalities among this population. And so while we somewhat controlled for this by making sure that all of our children with a history of NAS and children without a history of NAS were all enrolled in state Medicaid, we also included maternal education status as another marker of socioeconomic status. And then lastly, whenever you talk about outcomes of any sort of childhood or infant exposure, there's a lot of focus and concern about controlling for some of these prenatal factors like birth weight and gestational age that we know can have an impact on development and growth and other factors down the road. And so in the case of NAS, I think it's important to consider that, you know, none of these factors cause NAS. And there's no, in fact, it's the other way around. Babies with a history of NAS are more likely to have these adverse neonatal outcomes. And so we feel that these factors are much more on the causal pathway of how NAS is causing these adverse educational outcomes or challenges, and so we chose not to control for them because we wanted to look more at the total effect of NAS on this outcome than the direct effect. Although, if you're interested, I have data to show that even if you control for them, it doesn't really change the results of our outcomes of interest. So going back to our results. So when we looked at, the proportion of children who were referred for evaluation of a possible disability, we see that children with a history of NAS had 44% higher odds of being referred than children without a history of NAS. And again, we controlled for our matching factors, maternal education status, and maternal tobacco use. Next, we'll move to the results of the eligibility determination. So approximately 16% of children with a history of NAS met criteria for a disability and were eligible for services, as compared to 12% of those without NAS. And regression analysis showed that children with a history of NAS had 36% higher odds of meeting criteria for a disability than children without NAS. So when we look back at that list of qualifying educational disabilities in Tennessee, the five highlighted here accounted for over 95% of those identified among our sample. And we see that children with a history of NAS had a significantly higher proportion of them had special education exceptionalities of developmental delay or speech or language impairment. And this was confirmed with regression, as the odds of diagnosis of developmental delay or speech and language impairment were 34% and 26% higher in children with a history of NAS. So our third outcome was implementation of services. Children with NAS were significantly more likely to receive services than those without. And regression demonstrated that children with NAS had 37% higher odds of receiving services, such as physical therapy and others, than children without NAS. So we looked more closely at the different types of services received, and we saw that children with NAS were significantly more likely to receive accommodations or speech therapy. So examples of accommodations include extended time on an exam, perhaps being able to use a computer instead of having to write answers, being able to sit in a room with special lighting or have a study carrel to minimize distractions, things like that. And again, regression confirmed that the odds of receiving these services were over 30% higher in the children with a history of NAS. So there were several limitations to our analysis. First, we were unable to analyze all children born with NAS in Tennessee during 2008 to 2011. Matching to the special education database may have failed to match some children who had indeed been referred for evaluation. And we were unable to control for some factors in regression which have been shown to increase the risk of NAS, as I alluded to before, including SSRI use, cumulative antenatal opioid exposure, and opioid type. So in summary, this was a novel analysis linking health and education data sets, which showed that children with a history of neonatal abstinence syndrome were significantly more likely to be referred for evaluation of an educational disability, to meet criteria for a disability, specifically developmental delay or speech or language impairment, and to receive therapies or services, specifically accommodations or speech therapy. And there are multiple public health implications from this. First, efforts to reduce intrauterine opioid exposure might also reduce the risk of educational disabilities in these children. Additional resources may be needed for school systems in areas with high rates of NAS in order to ensure that students have the services available to them that they may need. And identification of infants with a history of NAS and prompt referral to early intervention services is really important for early diagnosis and treatment of possible developmental or learning disabilities. So there are a lot of folks across the state and beyond that helped with this project that I'd like to thank, and I'd love to take any questions.
Thank you.
Sure. So that's a great point. I think, certainly as with a lot of other disorders, fetal alcohol syndrome is a spectrum. And certainly on the far end of that spectrum, you know, you're going to see sort of classic phenotypic changes. They sometimes have very classic facies and other things that are make it a little bit easier to identify than something like NAS, where, you know, these are symptoms that may happen in 3 to 5 days after birth, but there's no outward changes that you might see in a baby born with NAS beyond those symptoms. Unfortunately, the data that we had does not inquire about maternal alcohol use. I think, you know, there's a lot of conversation around this topic, and obviously a lot of interconnected factors that are really important to consider. And I certainly think in an ideal study, it would be great to control not just for the things I alluded to, but also things like alcohol exposure. But unfortunately, those perfect data sets don't always exist in our world. But your point is well taken, and I think important to consider, especially if prospective studies are being put together and things like that. Sure. I think that's certainly important to consider. You know, I think we're fortunate in Tennessee that NAS has been a big focus for a number of years now. It's a reportable disease in the state. We have a separate reporting portal. And the biggest bulk of our cases come from more rural areas of the state. And actually, Dr. David Kursky, who's the medical officer at our Northeast Regional Health Department, I'm sure would love to chat with you more as well about that. But I think, you know, we have an NAS educator in one of our more rural health departments, and, I haven't gotten the sense, and Dr. Kursky, you may comment otherwise, that we're missing a lot of cases in those areas. We now are seeing upwards of 1,000 cases a year across the state, and I think there's certainly an awareness now, especially as the opioid epidemic sort of rages in our state, that this is a problem. But I think now the next challenge is not letting these children fall through the cracks after they're identified and treated appropriately after birth, and making sure that they get into early intervention services and are followed for some of these longer-term challenges.
Thanks. Yep. Thank you.